WTVB will collect. And yeah, that's it. So if you want to do introductions, Jen Brady, Tim, why don't you start?
Hi, I'm Tim O'Reilly. I'm the founder and CEO of O'Reilly Media. I'm widely credited with the Web2O meme, but actually it was Dale Dougherty, who works with us actually now on Make Magazine, who came up with the name. I came up with the ideas, but I was calling it different things. In 1997, I was calling it InfoWare. In 2001, I was calling it the Internet Operating System. It wasn't until Dale came up with the name Web2O in 2004 that the name stuck, the idea stuck. But it just goes to show that sometimes you can work on something for a long time before people catch on to the idea.
I'm Jennifer Polka. I'm with TechWeb. I'm the co-chair for the event with Brady. I work primarily on the design and user experience and marketing tracks. So Brady and I together do all of the Web2O branded programs except Summit, which John does. So happy to entertain any questions you have.
And I'm Brady Forrest with O'Reilly. I live in Seattle. And I handle the development and fundamentals tracks in business. I also chair two other conferences, Ware2O, which focus on geo and location-aware applications, and eTech, which this year is focusing on city tech.
Who wants to start?
On city tech? So how technology is changing our cities and ways of living.
And I'll just, again, start off by echoing what Jenny said. We really do appreciate all of you who sort of, you know, worked with us to get the word out and have covered this event, and appreciate that you have always done it from a perspective of your own integrity. So, you know, when you've liked what we've done, you've been vocal about that, and you're being vocal now. This year, I think most of you are finding it more positive. But anyway, we'd like to open it up to questions.
I have a question. Now the TechCrunch says that Web 2.0 can rest in peace. Are you planning to change the name of the conference next year? Or anyway, what's your take on this?
I know people have been saying that for a long time. And you know, I will say this: if you look at the origins of the name, everybody took it to be a version number. It is not a version number. You know, the reason we came up with the idea, it was actually in 2003. It was in the depths of the dot-com bust. Everybody was saying the web is over, right? And we said, no, the web is going to come back. And that was what we were trying to make the statement with the Web 2.0 conference. The web is back. So the only thing that will make us have a Web 3.0 is not a new technology. It's okay, if everybody stops believing in the web again, and then we have to say, hey, guys, pay attention. It's still here. Because it is still here. You know, fact is, there have been a lot of silly startups that have wrapped themselves in the mantle of Web 2.0. That didn't make them any less silly, and it didn't make Web 2.0 any less real. Web 2.0 is the shift to the network as the platform, and that is not changing. That is not going away. It's accelerating. It's getting bigger. It's getting more important. The network is penetrating more and more of our culture, more and more of our lives. It's changing in that it's moving from a network that's dominated by what we used to call computers to a network that's going to be dominated by mobile devices. And that's why you see, for example, Google with Android bidding on the Spectrum auction, doing all these things because they know that, you know, the phone has got to become, you know, part of the Internet. But that's just the beginning of it. You know, you look at you know, and this is maybe a long answer to a short question, tell me to shut up if I'm going on too long, but, you know, I've said that Web 2.0 is really about building applications for collective intelligence. That's what distinguishes the network as platform. Because it's not just, you know, when you get a new platform, it's not just that you get the old kind of applications on this new platform. And when we moved from the mainframe to the personal computer, it wasn't that you got mainframe apps on personal computers, although the first ones did look a lot like mainframe apps. You got a new class of applications. You got personal productivity applications. You got office productivity applications. And now on the web, you know, once you got to the Internet as platform, you got to applications that could only exist on a network platform. You know, and that's what really distinguishes Web 2.0. It's really the idea that certain things get better the more people use them, the more people are connected. And now this next phase, as we get into, say, mobile device that's always reporting your location, well, what kind of applications does that enable? You know, think about also, you know, I'm going to back up a little bit. A lot of the way I think is by watching what hackers and alpha geeks are doing And then thinking about what this is going to mean later when everybody's doing it. And what the hackers are doing right now is playing with sensors. You know, I made fun in my keynote the other day of the iPint application. But it's a clever application of a sensor that's in the phone. But there are others. There's something called the Quake Catcher Network, where somebody's built a SETI at home-like application to detect earthquakes using the motion sensors in laptops. There's Botanicals, where Katie London hacked up this cool project where her plants call her via the Astra server that's connected via the Arduino board to the moisture sensor in the plant, and they say, "Hey, I need watering," right? So that's a hacker thing, but it's also a foretaste of what's to come. Photosynth, Microsoft Photosynth, building 3D images out of photos. Well, what does that mean? It means that every time you take a photo and you upload it somewhere, to Flickr or whatever, you're actually being one more of the eyes of the global brain that we're building somewhere back there. And there are going to be new applications that take advantage of all that data. There's another, one of those sort of like data points that tell us about the shape of the future, startup funded by Kleiner Perkins called IMMI, Internet Measurements and Metrics. Right? It's trying to compete with Nielsen to measure television advertising. But what do? They give their panelists a special cell phone. It wakes up every 30 seconds, listens for 5 seconds, and said, "Do I hear a commercial?" Right? All of a sudden, an application that has ears. What's going to happen is we get these mobile devices, increasingly being part of our lives. It drives our social networks because our phone actually knows our social network way better than than a Facebook. They're going to drive our location-based applications, and they're going to eventually drive applications like 3D modeling. Another fascinating data point, from the future, talking with Carl Bass, the CEO of Autodesk, and he said, our workflow in Autodesk used to be that somebody sat down and designed something. Now they sit down and they take a bunch of pictures, and they get a 3D model that they start with, and so it's sort of people are sampling the world, and all this is going to be the mobile revolution isn't just about having web applications on phones. The mobile revolution is about once the mobile device is part of this global network and collective intelligence applications, what new kinds of things are going to be possible? And boy, they're going to blow us away. So Web 2.0 is not over. It may morph into something even more rich and strange, but it's not going to be over.
If I could add to that just a little bit in terms of the event itself.
Yeah.
I put you in pose.
Okay.
Okay, I can...
Just in terms of how it relates to the event itself, I think there's a tendency to see Web 2.0 as either, if you're very much on the cutting edge, to see it as a little bit corporate, and if you're sort of maybe in the media and looking at Web 2.0 as a meme that's gone very high, very fast, very quickly, the tendency to say, okay, well, let's watch it crash. The event has always been, since we launched the Expo brand in 2007, about 2/3 of the attendees are from companies of 500 people or more. So it's not an event that's just about startups, and it's not an event that's just about enterprise. It's an event that's about the sort of fertile connections between the two. So, we have the benefit of being able to look pretty far into the future and watch where the trend is going. We also have the benefit of being able to bring in people who are using these concepts in business in a way that isn't maybe quite as out there in terms of things like sensors, but bring it in a really real-world perspective.
But I want to bring in, when you say business is not as out there as the world of sensors, it actually, in a lot of ways, even the world of business is, in fact, on this same trend line.
Right.
I've been making this argument lately that, a lot of people, when they think about Web 2.0 and the enterprise, they think about a big company having a blog or a wiki. And I think about Walmart. Walmart is a lot like Google. They're an organization that is infused with IT. When you click on a link in Google, Google learns. Google does something different. When you take a product off the shelf at Walmart and check it out, Walmart does something about it. They learn. It's a live IT organization. And that, to me, is the heart of Web 2.0 for the enterprise, is how do you take all that corporate data, all that user-contributed data, because a purchase, for example, at a retailer is user-contributed data, and how do you take that and make it more alive and take IT out of the back office and build it into your organization so it becomes more responsive. And I think that the lessons of Web 2.0 for the enterprise are going to become very, very important, especially in lean times. And we already see this, again, you know, from this idea of the early adopters and the hackers showing us the shape of the future. You look at a company like Threadless.com, you know, a t-shirt manufacturing company, you know, but they use, you know, Web 2.0 dig-like functionality, a huge community of users who design t-shirts, other users vote on them, and when enough people say, oh, that one's really, really cool, Threadless makes them. And they've sold out of every product they've ever produced. Now, you don't think that's a lesson for business?
You know, about
how we can harness, the wisdom of crowds and collective intelligence and user, participation, right into something and remake, a very old school business.
Can you make your question? This is Andrea of Finland. Could you just say your name and your country?
Okay, I'm Andrea Vashilari. I'm CEO of ITV.net, and I live at andreavashilari.com.
I'm most interested in how the web helps us enrich our offline relationships. How online relationships enrich offline relationships and vice versa. And then whatever happens as a result of being there. I'd be interested to hear, I know how it happens within my network and my approach, but I'd be interested to hear from you what. How do you think that connection has affected your personal relationships with
people you meet face to face? Well, I think the Aki demo that showed up yesterday is a perfect example of where things are going. You'll have the opportunity to, you won't miss as many chances to interact with your friends in the real world. You'll have a better sense of where they are. But as was mentioned, about divorce lawyers and people getting caught, there's going to be stumbles along the way where you're revealing more about yourself. You'll have less control at first. And so it'll feel like people are really exposing themselves, and they are. But over time, software manufacturers, developers, and the users will learn how to set the proper permissions and how to basically control the access to their life and how much information they should share about their location in particular, but also about what they're doing right now, who they're with. And I think overall it'll really benefit us and our personal relationships. I find it a lot with Doppler. If I'm going somewhere, I know that, say, 50 other people are going to be there, and that two friends who live in town will be there as well, and that some other people will be gone. I know when people come to Seattle. And I'm able to make connections with them in advance.
Well, and it's not just people that you know. It's people that you might meet. Because I was twittering about my visit to Greece, a bunch of people, contacted me and said, hey, gosh, would you meet with us? I ended up doing a tweet up in Athens. I met a bunch of local, hackers who I would never have met otherwise. And, I thought that was just wonderful. In a similar vein, I realize I'm an unusual, case for Twitter because I have thousands of followers. My daughter was going to have her honeymoon in Portugal and was looking for places to stay in the Azores, and I tweeted that. Got back 20 or 30 really great responses from people saying, oh, yeah, this is a great place to go, that's a wonderful, use case. But also, I wrote emails with pictures that I sent back to my family. And then I thought, oh, I could share these with the world. So, put them up online, Twittered them. Lots of other people got to read them. And then that was a virtuous circle because other people said, oh, yeah, that was so cool. I went to see this. Did you see that? I started getting these communications from complete strangers became part of, of my trip.
Yeah. But you're having to deal with it. You're having to deal with classic fame thing that everyone knows who you are. When you walk into a room, everyone knows who you are, but not you don't.
But over time, some of those people you do become friends with, and there are people who I now would consider to be my Twitter friends, some of whom I've never met. And again, I've seen this. It was funny because it was one of those just amazing life experiences. Was when we did our first Pearl conference in 1997. And, because it was our first conference and we had never done this before. But there was a community that we dealt with by email, primarily in those days. And you knew people, and you had a sort of like a real sense of who they were from your online communications. And then for the first time, all these people got together, and literally many of them had never met. And it was sort of like all these and in fact, Larry Wall was a great example because I don't know how many, Pearl is no longer quite as fashionable as it was, but Larry, just from his online presence, I imagine him as this big red-bearded pirate, and he turned out to be this sort of very mild-mannered guy, and it was just like cognitive dissonance, the physical presence versus the online presence and the presence of the mind that had come through, in online discussions. Similar thing when I organized the first online, the open source summit, it was called the Freeware Summit back in 1998, it was because I realized that, all these guys had never met. Linus Torvalds didn't know Larry Wall and Guido Van Rossum and Brian Behlendorf from Apache. I was in a unique position where because of my publishing program, I knew a lot of these different people. And I said, my gosh, they don't know each other. Now, we take for granted that, these things, but I know this isn't really to your question of fame, but even there's always this case that in this online offline thing, you get to know people through this online medium, and then you get to know them in person, and some of them become good friends.
And I think the degree of serendipity that's involved in something like Twitter is actually driving more events. I think people have all seen that the past couple of years. It's not just the economy being strong in the past couple of years that's made there be so many events in this space. It's the fact that people want to get together in person with people that they've met online.
Yeah.
But it Twitter, in a weird way, really mirrors the real world in a way that email didn't, because of that serendipity factor, and even forums to some degree.
Yeah, and the design of Twitter is just brilliant because you have with the ability to follow without any acknowledgement. It means that you can track somebody who you're interested in. They don't have to do anything, but they know about it. But you have the ability to have a more direct communication with someone if it's mutual. I mean, it's really quite brilliant, and somebody says something about you and you hear about it and then you go, oh yeah, I better follow them, I want to know more about them. It's fun just thinking about it.
Yeah.
Dennis Howlett made a nasty comment about Web 2.0, so I started following him, and then he started following me, it's kind of fun,
but that's why really you guys did a lot of marketing for the event. I mean, that really speaks to that question.
Yeah.
I've
actually
had a question
about
from my Twitter screen.
Could
we just allow someone else to
Well, this is someone else, though, isn't it? You're saying it's from Twitter.
It's from Twitter.
Nick in Horsham says, as an owner of many, I mean many, O'Reilly books, I would love to know how Tim Fields' his books have contributed to Web 2 online.
Interesting question. There was back in the 90s, we ran an ad campaign that said the internet was built on O'Reilly books. And in the 90s, that was absolutely the case. No question in my mind. The number of people who said, I learned everything from O'Reilly books, was huge. I think it's less true today, to be quite honest. More and more people, learn, from other people online. They learn from, online reference material. I think we continue to play a role in, canonizing technologies. People take something more seriously when we publish about it, and we know that, and we use it in consciously sometimes to say, hey, pay attention to this technology. So a great example, we just published a book about OpenCV. It's the computer vision library, open source computer vision library. Why? Because I think that first of all, I saw it was amazing that the collective intelligence techniques they're using in Web 2.0 applications are also the same ones used in computer vision. And I went, okay, that was again part of this integrative thinking of saying, oh, what's happening with sensors is actually the same thing that's happening with collective intelligence applications. I need to make this connection for people. right? So I have that sort of power to try to guide things a little bit. But I think as far as the internet is concerned, that revolution is well and truly launched. And the power of our publishing now is possibly in other areas, like what we're doing with Make Magazine in celebrating this new do-it-yourself movement. You know, we brought it to prominence in a way that, it was really invisible. Whereas the internet, when we were doing it in the 90s, we were preaching to the world. Now we're preaching to the converted. Yeah. So. Okay, back over here.
My question is, I'm sure you've come across Andrew Keen and his Cult of the Editor, and obviously that's quite wrapped up with the whole Web 2.0 movement and user-generated content. He's quite contentious, and I'm sure we probably all have very different feelings about it, but I'd be interested to hear, what is your opinion of that? Do you think there's any merit in that?
No, I think Andrew Keen is a self-serving idiot. I mean, fact is, he's a guy who said, oh, wait, here's an angle I can use and exploit to try to, get some notoriety. I don't think there's any substance whatsoever to his book, and I don't have a lot of respect for it. I also think he's just flat out wrong. The fact is, the internet is great for experts. It's not all about some, dumbed down. When you search on Google, you tend to find the most authoritative response, and it's pretty good at finding that. And I just kind of take an example, from a very, highly professional area. Would you, take quantum physics? Would you like just the word of one expert? Stephen Hawking? Or would you also want to hear from Leonard Susskind, who actually talks about things from a very different perspective? And they've had a 30-year debate about certain points in quantum physics. It turned out Susskind was right, not Hawking. Right? And the fact is, the whole community of physics was having that debate. It wasn't one expert. And I think that, in that way, you have to, look at what we're enabling is communication and conversation. And yes, some people actually are more persuasive than others. I guess what I would say is Andrew Keen is exploiting some of the dynamics that he, decries. Just like, for example, Fox News on television, exploits them. Rupert Murdoch is a master of that. For that matter, so is someone like Michael Arrington. And Michael Arrington, knows that attitude helps sell. I forget the name of the guy who you had at on stage for the from TechCrunch.
Oh, Mike.
Yeah, same kind of thing. It's sort of like attitude, and I kind of feel like that's that's one way to go, but there's another way to go, which is substance. There's another way to go, which is really trying to figure out the best way to get the wisdom of crowds and an editorial process. Great example, when we were talking with Arianna Huffington of Huffington Post at Web 2.0 Expo New York. It was great. They have this whole process for bubbling up stories from their readership, but they also have an editorial war room that decides what's going to go on the front page. So they've actually figured out a great process for harnessing, the crowds of their readers and applying, editorial judgment and applying attitude and applying a strong, political point of view to drive readership. So there are really great examples of how all these things play out, and it's not this, there's certainly no dumbing down. I don't feel dumber because of the internet. I feel a heck of a lot smarter.
Spoken to quite a few people is when we're trying to educate companies about this, they tend to use that as one of the reasons why, we don't want to get involved in social media because it's a bunch of kids and things. And I know that's a challenge for a lot of us, and sometimes it's really difficult to try and convince, very traditional companies, very traditional CEOs.
Well, I would just suggest that they read some history, because all those same things were said about personal computers. Mm-hmm. It's nothing new. Conservative companies say, "Oh yeah, this is just kids. This is just fringe," and they're almost always wrong. They said it about Linux. They said it about You know, they said about the web originally.
Twitter.
You know, I mean, I had this great interaction back in 1993. I was doing, you know, advocacy about the internet. I was like, the internet is coming, the internet is coming. And I was asked to go speak to all of the staff at the U.S. House of Representatives. And I gave this talk. But first, I was asked to go in this back room with this small group of people. Turned out it was the House IT management staff. And they're beating around the bush, and I finally say, what's this meeting about? And one of the guys says, we don't want you to get them too excited about the internet because we're not going to give it to them. You know? You know?
No internet.
Well, guess what? You know, who was right? Yeah, I went out and got them very excited, and the fact is, there's always going to be conservative companies that don't get it. And the fact is, if you're on the right side of history, you know, and I think, you know, social media in business is the right side of history, you know, the companies that get it are going to have competitive advantage, and the companies that don't get it are going to feel the hurt, and then they're going to be playing catch up.
Hello, I'm Roman from Real World Web France, and I'd like to focus more on startups like we do with Startups Ignite. And I'd like to know, what do you think about social media adoption in startups and big companies, like having committee managers, evangelists, and other kind of tools and platforms like Dell, Starbucks, and so on. And another question is, what do you think about the global intelligence leveraging, and what would it change for startups' growth and the big company growth, like Walmart did with its failed social networks, and how Dell is managing to grow using Dell Ideastorm?
Was the first part of the question, what's the role of a community manager?
What do you think about social media adoption and social media marketing leveraging for big companies and startups? Does it have a future? How?
Well, I mean, if you guys jump in at any point, but I would just say absolutely. You know, those of us who've been doing anything on the internet for a long time know that social media marketing is... is the most effective marketing. I've been doing it for the last 15 years, and, you know, that's why you're here. You know, I started doing it in 1993 when I started marketing the internet, you know, when it was just coming out of its non-commercial phase. You know, I marketed open source, I marketed Web 2.0. You know, it's all been about community engagement. You know, that's what I am, a community manager. That's what I do for a living. That's what a lot of smart CEOs do. You know, Tony Hsieh at Zappos, you know, he's a community manager. You know, now, you know, not every big company, you know, is going to have their CEO do it. But even there, you know, someone like Jonathan Schwartz's son, you know, has taken that very seriously. You know, but other companies, you know, look at the role that Scovel played at Microsoft. You know, he really made Microsoft real for a whole, you know, new generation of people. You know, he was the face of Microsoft. And I think that... you know, companies are going to learn how to do it, you know, or as I said earlier, they're going to be, you know, in trouble. And I do think that there's a challenge for startups because, you know, there's a question, as a CEO, for example, or should you be focused on writing code or should you be focused on spreading the word? Yeah. And I think many companies, you have to actually end up with both of those roles. It may not be the CEO, but it needs to be somebody senior who can speak with authority for the company, and not just be a mouthpiece. I do think there are a lot of companies that get it wrong. You guys know that. If you're a blogger of any stature, you get all these boneheaded emails from PR firms trying to get your attention. And they obviously don't have a clue. I particularly love the ones when there's somebody I know, you know, the CEO of such and such, and then I get this, you know, thing from the PR firm saying, oh, you know, you ought to know that blah, 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 blah. And I go, you know, gosh, if, you know, so-and-so wants to talk to me, they can just, you know, send me an email or, you know, pick up the phone or, you know, tweet me, you know, whatever. I don't need you in the middle. Now, certainly there are things that a good PR firm can do and a really good PR firm is in fact a hired social media evangelist, but a lot of them are caught up in the forms, You know, you get something that looks like a press release, and you know, it goes in one mental bucket. You get something that looks like a direct communication, and it goes in a very different bucket. And I think that a lot of companies, you know, PR companies have never read the Clutrain Manifesto, you know, and they don't realize that, you know, it really is a conversation, that an informal email, you know, works better than a pitch, you know.
And we see that a lot in conference submissions. Chances are if a talk was put in by a PR firm, it's going to suck. If it was put in by the CEO, the CTO, or the lead dev, it's going to be great because they're going to share what they actually know. What I find is great about social media is it gives people a chance to approach the company, and because it's done not via email and some hidden back channel, everybody else gets to see the interaction and sees how the company handles it.
And to get back to the community manager question as well, we were saying the other day that in South Park in San Francisco now, in the 90s, everyone walked around saying, do you know a webmaster that I could hire? I need to hire a webmaster. And now everybody walks around and says, I need a community manager. Can't find me a community manager? But the truth is, nobody has a degree in community management. I mean, Jannetty's a perfect example of this. Jannetty's our community manager, and she moved to Berlin for the month to be here so that she could be around the people that she was going to be, you know, that we were going to be working with, so that she, you know, wasn't working all night, for instance, but also that she could have, you know, personal interactions with everyone. It's not that she went to school and got that degree. It's that she had the personality and the interest and the passion to come do that job. So when someone says, do you know a community manager that I can hire? Please, I'll give you a referral bonus. I say, you really can't hire one. You have to grow them. You have to find someone who's inclined that way, empower them, give them the tools, tell them that that job is important in your organization. That's really, I think, the only way to get a good community manager.
That being said, I think there will be opportunities in this downturn for many bloggers and people who are good at community outreach, actually, to if you're looking for a safe haven, becoming a community manager for a big company and helping teach them some Clue could be a good place to be.
And we're finding that when we run workshops at our expos on community management, they're packed. In New York, we did one. Lois Kelly did this great interactive session where people broke out into discussion groups and all this stuff. And the room was completely full the entire day because that's what companies really need. They need to understand how to do this. So, I mean, I guess in that sense, we are getting to the point where you can sort of train that person. It's not just on-the-job training.
But this scenario where customers come in handy. And Tumblr's first employee, outside of David and I forget his co-founder's name, was a community manager, and it was their most passionate user, a guy who'd been emailing them feedback and was subscribed to a ton of Tumblrs, or Tumbles.
Tumblogs.
And they hired him in Virginia. He was like an insurance agent previously. Mm-hmm. Totally different from David and his other 20-something co-founder in New York City.
Go ahead.
My name is Luca Conti. I blog in Italian, but I have also a new English blog, luca.wordpress.com. I went to Web 2.0 Expo in New York, and I think it's a very different kind of conference in compare with this one. You have a very worldwide view on Web 2.0 business. How do you compare Europe with the US from this point of view?
Well, so for each event, we try to reflect both the makeup of that community and what we think they want. And I would say NSF, it's kind of technology is what they're focusing on. They're exploring technology, going in new ways, and so that's what you really see there. In New York, it's a lot of agencies and then revenue focus. So design and marketing was really big. Most of the companies that come out of there are less technology focused and more, how do I make a business out of this? And you really saw that in both the attendance of the development talks and versus marketing and design, and then also the startups that you see there. And then here in Europe, we see a lot of technology, but then also how do you focus on European market and how do you differentiate yourself from other U.S. companies? Because a lot of U.S. companies, although they may have international exposure, they're really focused on the U.S. market, and then they just bleed over into other countries. And so what I see are a lot of European companies that do really well by learning from the U.S. companies and then focusing on these local markets and tailoring it to this country, their country, and the customs and what users here expect.
Can we
and the
bring
other
that
way
piece to the bloggers here on the round table? That would be awesome. We still have some of the questions.
Oliver, I'm blogging at Hermanngasse, which is the street name where our office is situated, and situated in Vienna. I'd like to know, how do you think the financial crisis will influence the Web 2.0 business itself? Because we feel that especially, let's say, marketing decision makers are having much more fear, and they're cutting down their budgets now.
Yeah. Well, you know, Well, you go first.
I'll be brief because I think your answer will probably be more thoughtful. But to me, again, it's about how you define Web 2. And I think we're a little bit schizophrenic in the way at least our events and how we define it, or rather it can look schizophrenic, but it's a much bigger hole than people realize in terms of it making that connection between the startup world and the enterprise world and sort of all over. But I mean, I think in a lot of ways, Web 2.0 can sort of be the recession diet for enterprises, I mean, who need to scale back their IT spending. They'll have to go to Web 2, and at least that there may be only one piece of what happens in the future, but I think that is one bright spot.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I mean, a lot of people associate Web 2 with advertising-based, you know, consumer startups, and a lot of those are going to be hurt, no question. And companies that don't have a revenue model that are hoping to get a lot of users and don't have one in an era of tight money, they're going to go out of business. But many of them would have gone out of business anyway, just sooner or later. You know, there is a historical perspective that I've always had on all this. I mentioned earlier the looking at the history of the personal computer. There were thousands of software companies in the 1980s for the personal computer companies. You know, but how many are there? By the 90s, not very many. You know, Microsoft, Computer Associates, Symantec. Yeah, a few. Borland was still around. But the fact is, consolidation happens. You know, in the early days of a market, there are lots and lots of possibilities, and those possibilities close down over time. Innovation then breaks out somewhere else. But so the advertising, bloom. Certainly will die back, but now we have cloud computing, and cloud computing is a great way, and cloud computing applications of all kinds are a great way for companies to cut costs in a down market. And so we're going to see a lot more, for example, paid services that are on, the cloud rental model, not just cloud infrastructure, but cloud applications. Google's got Google Apps, and they've kind of identified the big productivity applications. And by the way, Microsoft has admitted that, Google Apps is starting to bite into their sales, and I think that's going to accelerate. So that's going to be good for Google. On the other hand, there are an awful lot of small business applications that have been, are still untouched. And we don't really. There are some startups that are going after those, but I don't think we have anywhere near enough. If you look at Force.com, there's a whole Salesforce.com economy of software as a service, business-oriented applications, but huge opportunities there. Thousands of very specialized business applications, I think we'll also see. So we're going to see new investment in new areas. We're also going to see over time people are going to figure out the things that do work will in fact get more of the money. There'll also, I think, be increasing opportunities for people who were maybe thinking about startups to actually perhaps sell services to businesses instead, whether it's this area of sort of community engagement, social media, or whether it's other kinds of IT services. As companies try to rebuild their infrastructure and think about how to become more agile and nimble in the network era.
If you look at the show floor upstairs, there's very few companies that are advertising supported. The three main categories are enterprise, collaboration, productivity tools, mobile, and then there's some companies that are targeting marketing, so like articles and Xanos. That's just this year, right? I mean, it'll evolve further. but that's where we see, I mean, that's where we see this event going.
So you can see that as a mirror of the situation here in the, let's say, German-speaking countries or throughout Europe?
I mean, it's hard to say because these companies booked months ago, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, we're already not seeing as many companies who are in the, what people still think of, and I think is not necessarily true, as the typical Web2 ad-supported model.
Yeah, I think there's going to be a lot more paid business going on.
Yeah.
You know, because if you have a service that's really valuable to someone, and you say, you know, I mean, you had this idea that, well, maybe you get millions of users and it would be free and you get it supported by ads. Well, maybe you're not, you know, if you're not on the track to get millions of users, but you have a significant user base and it's really useful to them, they'll pay.
I'm really excited about physical good business. There was a great talk just given by Stefan Magdalinsky, the CTO of Moo, just about the differences in, he'd worked in tons of virtual businesses, and what it was like to switch to this, basically programming to physical goods and how it had to deal with manufacturing, printing, distribution. And we're starting to see more and more companies that do that. There was the Tween Jewelry Company that met this summer.
Yeah.
And there's Pinoco, which is a marketplace for goods designed. So you could design a table in SketchUp, upload it to Pinoco, and then other people can buy that design and have it manufactured by Pinoco. And I think we'll see more and more of those.
Yeah, I think e-commerce in general is an underrated business model for Web 2.0. You know, when you think, you know, about transactions, it's easy to forget. You know, there's sort of the e-commerce like Amazon, but there's also there are virtual goods, but there's also this new class of, you know, physical goods, mass customization,
mm-hmm.
Moo being a really great example.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's also subscription models. You know, we have, at O'Reilly, we have Safari Books Online, a subscription library access. It's actually now it's very close to our second biggest channel for distribution of our books. It's right behind Barnes & Noble, the big U.S. chain, and Amazon. And we may pass Barnes & Noble this year. You know, and it's a subscription business. Because we saw long ago that the advertising would not support the kind of content we want to produce. So there are many, many different business models to be explored.
You know, just an interesting tidbit about Moo that I learned. At launch, they had one product, one price, one currency, everything. And now they have 23 products and 5 currencies, and they're just expanding out like that.
My name is Sebastian. One of the things that you speak English podcast. At the moment, we have the financial crisis, which is impacting the Web2.0 industry. How do you see the outcome of the election maybe impacting not only the American landscape, but also the global scale?
Well, if Barack wins, I think we're going to see a really big focus on IT. Because he really seems to understand. I mean, I can't go into details, but I've been dealing with some of the people working on his tech team, some really smart people out of our community, doing really deep thinking about how can we use technology to build a better government. You look at what they've done in their fundraising operation. They show immense sophistication about social media. They basically, created a platform for people to work independently. And of course, that platform even, rebelled against them a little bit. And so I think he's got a sophisticated view. Now, it could be that the financial crisis will make it a little bit harder for some of those more ambitious sort of tech plans to go forward. But I also think that it could well be an opportunity, for us to really reinvent the way government happens. I think it's a wonderful defining moment, and it's great to see that Barack and is dealing a bunch with Eric Schmidt at Google. I think assuming the election goes that way, which I sincerely hope it does, I think we'll see some really good moves, and which hopefully will spread to other parts of the of the world as well. I don't think any of us know where it's all going to go. I mean, we're in pretty uncharted territory with regard to the financial crisis. But I do know this: if you look at previous large crises like the Great Depression of the 1930s. I mentioned this in my talk yesterday, great new industries were born in those periods. And, you know, it's easy to get all doom and gloom about it, but it can be a very positive time.
Two more questions. If you could just tag your tweets, W2EB, that'd be great.
Yep.
Oh, no, actually.
Okay.
Sorry.
One, then two.
I was just wondering, after your speech from yesterday, there's a lot of... I'm Arne Hilstein from Holland, by the way, forgot that. But there's a lot of startups in the audience hearing your talk on the demise of Me Too and non-original startups. And I was just wondering, we had this discussion with a couple of guys yesterday as well, but how many people do you think are actually going to, or in general even, with Me Too startups, are going to rethink what they're doing and trying to find a new and more robust angle, as you put it, on their...
Well, maybe not as a result of my talk, but as a result of the circumstances that led to my talk, they will, a lot of them. I'm just trying to call it as I see it happening, not to cause it. I think it's already happening. I mean, there are people who are, looking for, how to make their businesses more meaningful, and I think that's going to be, I think there'll be a lot of it. So, I mean, what else can you do? I mean, let's just say you can't get funded. Let's say you're a developer, and you can't get your startup funded. What are you going to do? Maybe you're going to get a job, doing something you don't love, and then you're going to work on something you love in your spare time. And guess what? That thing that you do because you love it, because it's so important to you, because it's going to work better than that startup idea that you thought was so cool that you'd get funded, right? Because, in a lot of ways, when you do what you love and what you're really passionate about, you find your way towards a business. And because a business is just a way of getting people to sign up, in some sense. When they give you money, you're getting them to sign up for a shared belief. When I started publishing books back in, my first print run of my first book was 100 copies. Actually it was two books. And we printed the same cover so we could save money. We had a little die cut hole in it so we could see through the title page, It was but it was like, hey, we thought, there's no good documentation on this stuff. Let's do it. Because we were a documentation company and we thought Unix was really cool and we wanted to share the knowledge. And, step by step, the market taught us that there was a business. We didn't think it was a business. At first we thought we might just give them away, to spread the word about this thing that we loved. And I think that, if you love computers, if you love what you do, you're going to do it even if somebody doesn't pay you for it. And because, nobody's paying you to do it, you're going to be more authentic. And I think that, and then when you're more authentic, you're going to find things that turn out perhaps to be better. Great example. Twitter is a great example. Evan raised money for Odeo, which seemed like a good idea, and it was too close to the center of the bullseye. Podcasting became part of platforms like Apple, and it was like, oh, maybe this wasn't such a good idea. And then it was just this sort of fun project that Jack Dorsey was working on, just because he thought it was cool, and that turned out to be the real opportunity. And I think there's so many times when we focus too narrowly on the profit motive that we actually blind ourselves to what we really love and what really is important. And when we follow that passion, we find something that actually works better.
Are you saying that startups are too much focused on money instead of what their product should be?
Yeah. There's a cycle kind of in technology. And when something becomes too fashionable, and it's too easy to get it funded because the payoff was so big, for companies like Google. Everybody says, "Oh gosh, let's place lots of bets," but it's a kind of gambling,
yeah.
Whereas when Google started, it wasn't a kind of gambling. It was like these guys who thought, "Hey, this is just a cool idea. We could make a better search engine." As I said at the time, nobody thought there was any money to be made in search engines. Alta Vista was like, nobody wanted it, And then, but they just thought they could build a better one, and it was a project that was a product of passion and idealism, and not a product of oh yeah, we can make a big killing, you know. And so you, the early stages of a market are actually when nobody believes in it are often the most attractive for the best ideas. Later on, you get a lot of people who are, in some sense, you know, they get blinded by the possibility of money.
It's like Oliver has been had to stand up for some.
Yeah.
This is the final question, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead. Oh. All right, then I'll do it. My name is Oliver, and I do blog, and I moderate the community for enterprise to all interested people. And my question will be, how long does it take, do you think, until the data portability thing will be widely adopted and accepted, and how will be the effects of our usage of the internet by this?
It's a very good question. Difficult to predict. I will predict that it will never be entirely adopted. I think it will be, what I would say is it's going to be a lot like what happened with free software. You know, you saw, Richard Stallman, you know, out in 1984 saying, you know, this is going to be an issue. It wasn't really till, 10 or 15 years later that everybody realized that he was right, that it really was an issue, that proprietary software was going to be a problem. But also, by the time people realized that it was no longer the problem because, free and open source software that was not political, that was not driven by Richard's, namely the internet, had taken over the world, right, and undermined Microsoft even more than Linux had.
So
what's going to happen? I think there will be a very strong, open data movement at some point that will be kind of analogous to the Free Software Foundation. But what will really kill, sort of the proprietary data silos, is that somebody will figure out an architectural solution or a type of program or whatever, something that spreads, wildly, that actually depends on free data and open data. And that free and open data, architecture that takes over the world unexpectedly because it works, because it matters, because it enables new things, is what will undermine the proprietary data silos. Not the fact that we've, tried to legislate it or because ultimately, and I quoted this morning in an interview with a journalist, this is fabulous quote from Lao Tzu, of Taoism, and the way of life, according to Lao Tzu. He says, losing the way of life, men rely on goodness. Losing goodness, they rely on laws. And, we keep trying to legislate some of these things. And I think, first of all, I think that people are fundamentally good, and a lot of what happens on the internet is driven by idealism. But even more powerful than that is the way of life, and that is figuring out an architecture, a design that actually just works. Richard Stallman was trying to legislate, free software. But the design, the architecture of the internet made free software happen because it just worked better than proprietary. And I think, that's where we're going to get to. We'll figure out some new ways where it just works better. It is the way of life, to be have free and open data.
So the adoption of data portability will be like a natural process.
That's right, yes. It will be a natural process. And what we can do, I think, of course, is to seek out those ways in which we gain advantage by being open. And that is, in fact, what companies are doing. And you see it already. Yahoo with Fire Eagle. They're saying, wow, how do we get competitive advantage by being open?
And I think you're seeing this already implemented in the Open Web Foundation. And really, the protocol or the spec that I think is driving this or the best example of this is OAuth, which is a great way of sharing out data without giving taking away user control. And so you see it with Flickr. Hopefully, someday we'll see it with Twitter, Doppler. These are all great usages of this that are allowing people to share their data out.
Isn't this more about the ownership of data?
Data portability? Well, if you're not going to get this decree that says that all data can be moved around, even if you did, you're still going to have to decide access. You're going to still have to figure out syncing of that data. And that's where something like OAuth comes in, where people are able to move data around between applications and control who has it and control who's the master of it.
So the fundamental thing I think that's also important to understand in the web era, we may own our individual data, but when the value comes from having our individual data be part of a collective, it's very hard to take it out. You know, I mean, this is the story of robots.txt, right? You know, so yes, you own your website data, but you really don't want to be in Google, you know. You know, that was fought. There was a law case back in the 90s where you know people were saying, oh, you know, we don't want to be spidered. Well, before long, it was sort of like, you know, give me a break. You know, you don't want to be spidered? Are you nuts? Brewster Kahle at the Internet Archive used to, you know, he did this with television too. He would put all this stuff in the archive and people would say, no, take it out. And he'd say, oh, you don't want to be part of the public record? And they would say, oh, yeah, I guess I do, you know. And you know, there's some real challenges there because this is a world in which collective data is extremely valuable. And when we pull ourselves, what we take out of the collective may become less valuable even to us.
Okay. Well, I know that there's probably a lot of questions. Do you have a quick one? Because you had gone.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
I'm Donato, I'm a blogger, and I work for Passpart, that is an online privacy manager. And I would ask, Web 2.0 applications, let us share with others whatever we want. Don't you think there's a need to keep relevant information in privacy, or at least to share it with people you really trust and you really know?
Absolutely, and there are no question in my mind that tools for privacy are really, really important, and architectures that support privacy so that you can make a choice about, you know, what you share and what you don't. My daughter had an experience with that recently where, a picture, she was having all her pictures be public in Flickr, and then, you know, Valleywag used one of them, you know, and it was like, oh, you know. And all of a sudden, all of her pictures became private, you know. And that's where I do think we have to also, you know, respect. I sent mail to Valleywag and said, you know, you just did something, you know, bad for the internet, you know. And every time you guys, you know, do something ugly with data that people have made public, you know, it's one more small step towards people not trusting each other and not sharing. You know, so I think we're gonna, you know, but we figure it out. It becomes a social give and take, and we learn, and eventually, you know.
We can trust in the global brain.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, look at ourselves. We are, you know, I really think we are building a global brain. It's a good analogy, and it's going to be flawed, just like we are. It's back to the Andrew Keen question. It's not a matter of, you know, perfect intelligence and perfect stupidity. It's a matter of a mixture of intelligence and stupidity, of brilliance and idiocy, all in the same, you know, in the same brain. You know, of failures of will, failures of virtue, you know, failures of goodness, at the same time as we have enormous heroism, enormous accomplishment. All these things are going to be true of internet applications just as they're true of individuals.
That's a great note to end on.
So all you people who have these wonderful recordings, I hope you will send us links or email.
Yeah, please DM us the web, at W2EEurope08, and I'm collecting and I'll repost on the blog all the links.
Yeah.
So share them with us. And if you haven't tagged the tweets, then send me what you did tag. Like, okay.
You can also send me email, tim@o'reilly.com. I'd be happy to hear from any of you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.